You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 6 of a series in John's Gospel. John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw out some and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to them, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Now, I've made the point in the previous episodes in this series, if you've listened to them, that John's Gospel is presenting to us evidence for who Jesus is. We see a number of people and of things that are described as giving testimony. We've seen already John the Baptist, and we're told that he bore witness, as if John, the writer of the book, is setting up a courtroom scene, and John is the first witness to have come along. Well, one of the other sources of evidence that's providing testimony to who Jesus is the miracles that he performs. And John records, it's generally recognized that he records 7 miracles. Although John doesn't call them miracles, at least that's not his common name for it. Some of the other Gospels use the word dunamis, which means mighty works or powerful works, to describe miracles, and John doesn't use that. Another one which is the Greek word terata, which means wonders or miracles, is only found in John together with the word that is his preferred word, which is semeia, or signs. And that's what John uses in this passage when he describes the events in Cana. Verse 11 says, "This the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee." And I've said that it's generally recognized that there are 7 signs in John's Gospel. There are also 7 I am sayings, but again, there's a little bit of dispute as to which are the 7 signs, because they're not numbered. This first one is numbered in this way, the first of his signs. But we'll pick that up as we go through the gospel. That phrase, though, the first of his signs, is an interesting phrase, because just as in English you might call something first because it happened first chronologically, you might also call something first because it was the most important, it's ranked first. And some commentators suggest that actually that's what John is saying, or he's deliberately saying both that this was the first in time, but also that it was the first in significance. And that might seem odd. Whenever we read some of the other miracles, you might think they're greater than this one. But whether it is the first in significance or not, certainly this miracle is more significant than it might seem at first glance. So this miracle has caused some difficulties at times for Christians as they try to read the New Testament, especially in periods whenever it has been normal in cultures and contexts where it's been normal for Christians to abstain from alcohol, or within movements and denominations where that is the norm. So throughout certainly the 19th and 20th centuries, there were movements of Christians in various different denominations that really called for Christians to abstain. In my own part of the world, in Northern Ireland, it certainly was the norm that Christians didn't drink alcohol at all, that they would be teetotal. Even when I was at medical school, we were told about a third of the population in Northern Ireland doesn't drink at all, about a third drinks to excess, and about a third drinks in moderation. So large problem with alcoholism and abuse of alcohol and all of the problems that that brings with it in Irish culture, especially amongst men. And in reaction to that, Christians opted to be teetotal, opted not to drink at all. But of course, the Bible doesn't command us not to drink at all. It does tell us to avoid drunkenness. It tells us to avoid strong wine as well, strong alcohol, because it's a mocker. And I think we should take that very seriously. Personally, I wouldn't drink spirits. I think we should be very careful about inebriation. But we can't say on the basis of the Bible that it's wrong to drink any alcohol, although there might be very good reasons for Christians in certain settings today not to drink, or even for personal reasons, perhaps because of an addictive personality or because of responsibilities that mean that they want to be available at all times in emergency situations. But there undoubtedly are cultural norms around this. Of course, Christians should also think, whenever they're considering any lifestyle choice, about the impact it will have on other people, whether it might cause them to stumble or might cause difficulties for them. The other thing to say as well is that although the passage that we've read makes reference to the possibility of people being inebriated when the man says in verse 10, the master of the feast says to the bridegroom, everyone serves the good wine first and people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you've kept the good wine until now. Well, when he says that, the implication is, of course, that people get a little bit inebriated as they go along and they don't notice the taste of the wine so much once it's had a bit of effect. But that doesn't mean that they're drunk. You only need to take a bit of alcohol for your senses to be lessened and for the social factor of alcohol to kick in, and you don't notice the taste of things so much. You're more caught up with the social engagement. But the other thing to say is that commentators tell us that the wine at the time when Jesus was performing this miracle would have been much weaker than the wine we use today. So it might have been diluted with water to about a third or maybe even one tenth of its strength when it was fermented. So a sort of weak beer level by modern standards. So that should make us think about how we engage with alcohol. But anyway, the point I'm getting to is that this passage shouldn't cause embarrassment because it doesn't clash with anything else in Scripture. It has been described in history as being the profane miracle, or by some commentators, because it sounds very worldly, doesn't it? It sounds very ordinary, down to earth. And of course, that ordinariness has proven significant. Often this passage is quoted or preached on at Christian weddings to show Jesus' approval of marriage. You know, we don't need to see him at a wedding to know that he approved, because he teaches about marriage elsewhere. And of course, he upheld the whole of the Old Testament, which also upholds marriage and the significance of marriage. But it is nice to think of Jesus celebrating at a wedding, isn't it? Entering into the celebrations and enjoying the celebrations. It tells us something about the true humanity of Jesus, doesn't it? Here he is, a real man engaging in a real social context with real relationships with real people, and doing what real people do. And if we ever think that everything Jesus did was highly super spiritual and removed from the ordinary realm of existence, well, here, as in other places, we see a very real human being, a man, who is engaging with others in their context. So yes, Jesus blesses weddings by being at the wedding in Cana. Yes, Jesus shows us his true humanity. But there's also things in this passage that tell us just how different Jesus is. The first of those is, again, at a very human level, and that's how he interacts with his mother. You'll notice that John doesn't name Mary. She only refers to the mother of Jesus as his mother. And she's mentioned in chapter 19 again. We see there that Jesus from the cross entrusts her to the care of John, the beloved disciple. And a couple of other times she's referenced in chapter 2, verse 12, and chapter 6, verse 42. John doesn't name her, and it might be because the name Mary is so common and there are other Marys in the Gospel of John, and he doesn't want to cause unnecessary confusion. But that's not the striking thing here. The striking thing is the way Jesus speaks to her. She comes to Jesus and says they have no wine. Why does she come to Jesus? Well, of course, it seems from the Gospels, since we only hear about Joseph early on in the life of Jesus, the last reference to him is when Jesus is 12 years old in the temple. It seems as if Joseph almost certainly died at an early stage, a relatively young age. Jesus is also referred to as the carpenter. I think it's in Mark's gospel. He's not just described as the son of a carpenter, but as a carpenter himself. And it suggests that Jesus may have been the main breadwinner in the house. Mark chapter 6, verse 3 is the reference, by the way. He might have been the main source of income for Mary. He was certainly the eldest of her children, although not the only child. He may well have been the one that she looked to and depended on. And of course, his character being such as it was during those 30 years before he began his public ministry, undoubtedly Mary would have trusted in him, would have turned to him not just for provision. As a widow in her context, she needed that provision and protection from him, but also for his wisdom, his resourcefulness, his insight. And so she does what undoubtedly she had done countless numbers of times before. She comes to him with the issue at hand and asks for his help in this situation. And it's Jesus' response that is remarkable. He says, "Woman, what does this have to do with me?" Now, again, commentators tell me it's difficult to translate this phrase that is translated woman. The word literally means woman, but of course when we say that in English it could sound rude or harsh. Strangely enough, being a man from Ulster or Northern Ireland, it's interesting that the commentator F.F. Bruce suggests that perhaps the closest to this is an expression that we would use here, or some people would use in my part of the world, saying woman dear. In other words, it's not a rude term. It's not just sort of calling her a woman. It's actually it could be used in an endearing way, but it's certainly not the way a son would normally speak to his mother. He doesn't call her mother. He doesn't use that family term. In other words, he's treating her as if she was just another person, a person to be respected, yes, and treated well, but not as somebody within the family. And that tells us something about Jesus now that he has begun his ministry. Of course, John hasn't given us any insight into his birth or into his upbringing. So this is our first introduction to his family. And what we see is Jesus distancing himself from his family, distancing himself from his mother. No longer will he be tied to her in the way he has been for 30 years. No longer will his home be in her home. No longer will he be under her direction. No longer will she be able to call on him at will and have a closeness to him that others will not have. He's now going to be focusing on his disciples. It's them that he will be closest to. It's with them that he has come to the wedding. And by disciples in verse 2, of course, it almost certainly means the four that we've read about already, Andrew and Nathaniel and Philip and the other disciple who was with Andrew, who some commentators think might have been John himself, but who isn't named in chapter 1. Well, how does Mary respond? We can imagine how she might have felt, but John doesn't tell us how she felt. She simply says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Here, Mary has become not the mother of Jesus, but a believer in Jesus. And we know that Mary did become a believer in Jesus. She's there at the cross amongst the other women. And so she's on a journey of faith, or towards faith in her son. But Mary is not, or rather what Jesus says to Mary is not simply woman. He says, what is this to do with me? My hour has not yet come. And that's an interesting phrase that Jesus uses. On one hand, you could read it very simply to mean, well, it's not the time yet for me to do this. Although, of course, he does go ahead and do something about it, doesn't he? He does react and he does perform the sign and solve the immediate problem. The problem, of course, is that it's a great shame in a culture that is driven by shame-type relationships. It would be a huge social shame for the bridegroom, whose responsibility it was to provide for the feast at the wedding. In that culture, that's the way it was done. Well, what a great shame for him if they don't have enough wine for the meal. What does that mean about him? What does it say about his devotion to his wife and the honour of her family? And Jesus does respond to that need. But that's not all that he means by saying, my hour has not yet come. That's a phrase that will crop up several times again in John's Gospel. And in all of the other occasions where it turns up, it's to do with his death on the cross and the fact that through his death on the cross, he will be glorified and exalted. You see that in chapter 7, verse 30, or chapter 12, verse 23 and 27, chapter 13, verse 1, chapter 17, verse 1, and also in chapter 5, verses 28 to 29. And so already we're being introduced to this idea. Of course, Mary wouldn't presumably have understood that that's what Jesus was talking about. But as we read through the gospel, we'll get this sense that Jesus is working not to Mary's agenda or to anyone else's agenda, but to the agenda and the timing and the routine, if you like, that has been laid out for him by his Father in heaven. He's come to do his Father's will, and he's going to do his Father's will in his Father's time. His time has not yet come. The cross and his exaltation has not yet come. Well, what has that got to do with wine and a wedding? And it's here that we have to understand the Old Testament background. And this is telling us now, this is the beginning of our understanding that it's not just a wedding feast. It's not just a human moment, but there is a spiritual, eternal, divine significance in these events. Because the Old Testament describes the wedding feast that will come in the future. Theologically, we would call it the eschatological wedding feast, the end times wedding feast. The wedding feast when God's new creation will be brought in. And wine is very much part of that. Read Jeremiah 31 verse 12 and Hosea 14 verse 7 and Amos chapter 9 verses 13 to 14. References to wine flowing in the celebration that's to come in the wedding of the Messianic age when God is united with his people. And if we're not sure yet that that's what Jesus is thinking of, well, if you skip forward to chapter 3 and verses 27 to 30, there you'll see that John the Baptist who hasn't disappeared yet from the scene. We've heard about him in the last couple of episodes. But John the Baptist refers specifically to himself as the friend of the bridegroom. In other words, identifying Jesus as the bridegroom. So when Jesus says, my time has not yet come, or my hour has not yet come, he's saying the hour for his wedding feast has not yet come. When will that be? Well, Revelation talks about the wedding feast of the Lamb. And Ephesians 5 talks about Jesus loving the church the way husbands should love their wife. The church is the bride of Christ. Christ has come to bring the church to himself, but he knows that that can only happen through the cross. And so as Jesus goes into action, it is with the symbolism of that coming new messianic age that this miracle happens. That's why it's a significant sign, a sign of the new creation. There's another hint of that, of course, isn't there? I emphasized in the last episode that John in chapter 1 repeatedly talks about the days, the next day and the next day in the second part of John chapter 1. Well, what's that all about? If you add up the days from the day whenever John the Baptist speaks and commends Jesus. So we have in chapter 1, verse 29, it says the next day. So on the first day, John talks about the one who's coming after him in chapter 1, verse 26. The next day, day 2, John says, behold, the Lamb of God. And then the next day, verse 35, John is standing with two of his disciples and again says, behold, the Lamb of God. And the disciples hear it and follow him, and they spend the rest of the day in that house. And then in verse 40, it says one of the two was Andrew, and he found his own brother. That must be on the next day, day 4. And then the next day, verse 43, Jesus goes to Galilee and finds Philip. And then we're still in Galilee, of course, Cana being in Galilee, but it's on the third day after that, which is two more days on, which makes this the seventh day. Now, of course, we need to do a little bit of maths to do that, didn't we? We wouldn't have seen that just at first read or reading over quickly. But of course, a book like John, and John is very careful in how he writes and how he constructs this, is meant to be plumbed for depths of meaning, not hidden meaning, but depths of significance in the words and details that are included. This is the seventh day since John has announced that the greater one is coming. And if it's the seventh day of the creation week that is in view, then it's the Sabbath. And of course, this may well be a Sabbath day. We don't know that from the text. But the point is that it's symbolic of the Sabbath, the day of rest and of celebration, the end of God's work. And of course, Jesus' work hasn't finished yet. His hour has not come. There has to be his death and his resurrection first, before he can enter into his rest. But this is new creation symbolism, isn't it? The seventh day. And the other part of that, of course, is that Jesus tells them to use 6 stone water jars, each holding 20 or 30 gallons, or as the footnotes will tell you, about 35 litres. For one of these measures, and it's 2 or 3 of those, so we're talking about 90 to about 120 litres per jar, and there are 6 of them, so more than 600 litres probably of water. But these are stone jars that are used for Jewish rites of purification. And why does Jesus choose those jars to be used? Not just presumably because they're big. I mean, he could have used the empty wineskins or whatever the wine that had been used up had been in, couldn't he? It's the fact that these are used for the Jewish rites of purification that is another sign that this miracle is telling us that something new is going to come. The water that's used in the old covenant rites is going to be turned into wine, the new covenant. Elsewhere, of course, Jesus talks about old wine and new wineskins and so on. You don't put new wine into old wineskins. There have to be new wineskins. Here, it's the new wine that's in emphasis, the wine of the Spirit, the age to come. And that's a theme that will carry through the rest of chapter 2 and into chapter 3. So we'll see that this sign, the first of these signs, is telling us that Jesus has come to bring about the age of the Spirit, a new kind of worship of God, to replace the Old Testament system of worship with a new system. He'll carry on to show how that relates to the temple in the second half of chapter 1. In chapter 3, he'll talk about new birth through the Spirit. And in chapter 4, he'll encounter a woman at a well and tell her that a new day is coming when people will worship God in spirit and in truth. Of course, the people who receive the wine don't get it. The servants know what's happened. They draw out the water and it's not water at all, at least by the time it reaches the master of the feast. It's the best wine. Of course it is. It is newly created. It is the wine of the new creation. It is the wine of Jesus' reign, the best of wine. And it confounds the master of the feast, because he thinks the bridegroom has done it. But why would he have kept the best wine until the end? It doesn't make sense. Well, they're confused, but the disciples know where it came from, and they know that this is the beginning of the manifestation of Jesus' glory. Verse 11 says, remember in chapter 1 it said, we beheld, John writing said, we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Here is the first of these grace signs, the grace of God in the coming of the new creation, the coming of the messianic age and the good. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, I mean, I'm talking about the significance of it, but the fact that it's wine shouldn't be lost on us, because it's a joyful thing. The new creation is something to get excited about and be happy about, and it is a grace from God, and the disciples begin to see his glory in this sign. He won't ultimately be glorified until he hangs on the cross, but here's the beginning of his glorification. And they begin to believe in him, having followed him in the hope that this might be the Messiah. Now they begin to believe that he must be the Messiah. And after it, he goes to Capernaum with his mothers and brothers and disciples, so the family with him, as well as his disciples. And they stay there a few days. What do we take from this passage? Well, we take that God approves of marriage, and Jesus certainly did. If you're not married, that's fine. It doesn't mean you have to get married, but it does mean that the intimate sexual relationship between a man and a woman is given for the marriage context. So don't belittle that. But also, marriage is a God-given thing. So if you're married, make your marriage a God-centered one. But it's much more than that. Jesus has come to give us the new life of the age to come, so that we can be part of his wedding feast and part of his bride, whether we're married or single. That's the day that we're looking forward to. And it will be a day of the best wine. So believe in Jesus like the disciples did, and obey Jesus like his mother did.